It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running on this fourth day of March, 2024. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. That's where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time, madcap, multimedia extravaganza that is The Horn chat room in the 3 hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, all time zones in between, and the great globe round. And where if you want to jump into the aforementioned merry, wacky, zany, it's terribly easy to do. Just go to headon.live, click on chat room, pick out a screen name and a password, and you will be immediately and joyfully greeted, don't let me down, y'all, by Anatole and Ralphs and Squeaky and Theo. Hi, gang. And capably moderated by Horn Chief Agronomist, Chief Mathematician, Bud Trimmer Emeritus, and Zimmergist Extraordinaire, Roger in Oregon. Hi, I'm Robin. It's Moran Monday, and it is the first full week of March 2024. We got off to a good start with a great front porch on Friday, I thought. And, well, I'm looking for... We've had some beautiful days, and I hope it just stays like this and we don't get some godforsaken blizzard at the end of March or an Easter snowstorm or any of that... Because, yesterday was wonderful. Perfect blue skies all day. It got up to like 72, 73 degrees here. The sun was out. I felt warm. I felt the warmth of the sun on my skin, and I think I darkened up a couple of freckles, and it was wonderful. And something else was wonderful, too. Oh, by the way, if you're listening to the podcast, please be so kind as to like each episode and maybe leave a comment or a review. Brother Deacon Asa is beginning to despair that anyone ever will. If you're listening on TuneIn, hit that heart button. Maybe we'll eventually get to 1,000 indiscreet listeners but at some point. But it really does help, and it makes the it helps the algorithm to make us more visible, this little conversation that we have. But yeah, yesterday was super wonderful. Not just because the weather was pretty, but the weather was good enough that Annette and I went out into the yard. It makes it sound like I live in a prison, doesn't it? No, we went out to the yard and we began the process of assembling the acorn. Almost a year later, and after the abject disaster that was the attempt made in the summer to put it together, well, I went back and took every last piece that Ferg had put together. I took it apart, found out the wrong bolts were in the wrong places. Those three screws that we waited forever to come from China, y'all, I found them. There were actually four. I found three of them. I may yet find the fourth. Ask me, Roxanne, where were the three screws? You thought they were lost in the grass. I did. They were just kind of randomly screwed into a random hole that he decided they fit in. That's where. But we got the rack built and everything. I've got the wheels on it. And so probably tomorrow, I'll be finished with it and burn it in, hopefully before airtime tomorrow. And then I'm going to the store and I'm going to get a pork shoulder. And I'm going to have pulled pork because I haven't had any for so long. And make the world famous Dick Howell's hot barbecue slaw. Get some good buns and just have pulled pork sandwiches to. You know what? I also need to go online and order a bottle of, and everyone who likes barbecue sauce should order a bottle of Dreamland sauce. Cynthia, sister, go on Amazon, order a bottle of Dreamland sauce for when you get around to doing your ribs. It's the best. It's the best thing on ribs that's ever been devised. But every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude, and this program is no different. So thanks go out to our fourth, third, and second day of the month subscribers via PayPal. And what that means is we say thank you. We say thank you to Paul. Thank you, Paul. And thank you to Stephen. And thank you to Kim and Malin in New Jersey. Hey, y'all. Thank you, Thomas. Thank you, Carl in Phoenix. Thanks as well to Anne across the pond. Thank you, John. And thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you all for being partial sponsors of the program and helping to keep this little experiment in independent, liberal, progressive broadcasting, non-commercial, no commercials, non-profit-driven, on the air for over 20 years. And hopefully we will continue that. The fundraising goal for this evening is just a simple $300. And, well, we had a miraculous February. And hopefully March will keep up with pacing, too. But if you want to help out, the PayPal button is at headon.live, and that's how we keep all of this going. Keep thinking about wanting to do another horn in, but I don't know. Just kind of depends on interest. Emilio says, Robin, shame on you. Are you throwing Ferg under the bus as far as his mechanical abilities go in putting together your grill, smoker, barbecue, or gizmo? No, it's just a reflection of reality. And we had a good laugh about it, and his mom and I had a good laugh, and yesterday was just something near perfect. Meanwhile, Matt in San Francisco, screws, stop telling me what hole to put my screw in, Roxanne, and keep your pork pulling to yourself. Ah, we're off and running. It's Monday. Oh, yeah. I'm going to make some jalapeno poppers on the grill once I get it up going real good, too. And so that'll occasion the poppers. Oh, wait, email from Matt. You meant jalapenos. Yep. Yes. I'm getting there. Yes, perhaps indiscreet listeners. Because I want people to be indiscreet and talk about the program and help. Let's build the community. Note coming in from Cynthia to get us started. And I still haven't been able to burn my acorn in. It keeps raining and threatening rain, so it's still sitting in my tough shed waiting for the chance. Oh, and I'm fantasizing about those ribs. Oh, my. Oh, they're going to be so good. And, well, you know, just go ahead and be ready and order your bottle of Dreamland barbecue sauce. And it's just, it's not terribly spicy, and it's not all thick and syrupy. And it's perfect on ribs. And for people who count carbs, like, you know, yours truly, very low carb. And yet, you know, no artificial sweeteners or anything. It's just perfect. And I think you'll enjoy it. Cynthia earlier, just a little bit before airtime, sent me a note and said, I watched Napoleon on Apple TV Plus, and I liked the ending. Napoleon sent to exile for the rest of his stinking, warmongering, murderous life. Can we please do that to Trump? Exile the bastard to some place he'll never be seen or heard from again? And we'd all be the better for it. I'm sure. I'm sure we would. And you, Cynthia, you provide us with a good jumping off place. Cynthia's looking at the Dreamland sauce now. It looks yummy. Oh, it's unlike anything anywhere else. And it's an Alabama institution. It's a phenomenon. Because, you know, there's a lot of mustard-based ones out of Carolina and some real thick and sticky ones. And I think they specialize, if I recall what Scott said, that, like, the barbecue sauces in Kansas City are pretty thick and pretty sugary and sweet. And if you're into that, fine. It chars up real nicely. It caramelizes well on the grill. But I just like tart and tangy because I feel like it brings out the hickory smoke and stuff more. Well, tell me when you taste it, Cynthia. But no, Cynthia provides us with a good jumping off point for the program today, simply because of what happened in the Supreme Court. Oh, and by the way, Miss Tara and I will be filling in for Malloy on Progressive Voices on TuneIn this evening, so we'll be talking about the Supreme Court stuff too. And now I'm not being a crank here, and I'm certainly stop telling us that. No. But as I mentioned to Tara, we are a traumatized nation. And of course, fascism loves that. Because it will paralyze us. It'll make us afraid to speak out and speak up. And that makes it easier for fascism to carpe the DM. And so that's the last thing we can afford to do. So I thought we would take what I hope will be a fairly unjaundiced view of what the Supreme Court did today. I have heard from some of you privately through the day, and you're disgusted. Flavio and Micah are both disgusted by the Supreme Court's decision today. And I'm not much better. But I feel like I tend to understand when fascists do fascist things. And make no mistake, old Balls and Strikes and Ann's boy Neil Gorsuch and Clarence Pubes on the Coke Can Fappy Thomas and Sammy Bad Breath Alito and Beer Boofing Brat are fascists, okay? I think that when, you know, in old ancient lore, in order to defeat a demon, you have to be able to call it by its name. And so consequently, and they finally caught up with us. Well, sort of. We're still out in front of the curve. But over there on my filthy morning habit, they're calling fascists fascists. Not so much yet with ABC, CBS, NBC, you know, mainstream. but we know them. We know them for what they are. And that's the first step in defeating them. So you probably already know the ballot decision came down today, and they posted it on their website instead of waiting until a scheduled court day to announce it from the bench. They kind of had to. They were forced to this action by the simple fact that tomorrow is Super Tuesday. Tomorrow is Colorado and a whole host of other states. Not this one. Now, that's May 14th. We always vote after everybody else has made our decisions for us. But they said, our most puissant dread sovereign supreme Catholic majesties, by a 9-0 margin. And you want to talk about being oversold. The tiny little scintilla juris that is a 9-0 decision is being oversold. They were unanimous. Trump should be on the ballot. They said no such thing. They want him to be president. No, not that either. They said what I said all along, and that is that the word ballot, neither the word ballot nor the word election nor vote. Well, okay, I take it back on vote. But neither election nor ballot appears in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And so there was really nothing for them to take Colorado's side on in that regard. It does not speak to ballot access. The only thing that only two things that I can think of in regard to ballot access that the Constitution addresses where the presidency is concerned is the minimum age and the citizenship requirement. Natural born citizen. That's it. Now, that's not to say that this is a good or a right decision. That part of it, the unanimous part, you know, the smart members of the court, the three allegedly liberal women, agreed. But it does not mean that he can be president. And I hope that we can maintain enough of our serenity, equanimity, to realize that. Now, do criminal dirtbags like Clarence Pubes on the Coke Can, Fappy Thomas, and Sammy Bad Breath Alito, and Beer Boof and Brat, and Ann's Boy Neil Gorsuch, do they want Trump to be the president? I have no doubt whatsoever. I'm cutting the handmaid a little bit of slack because it turns out that the unanimous decision, the 9-0, was almost nothing. It's in the concurrences where you find out what's really going on in their thinking. And wow, did the maggot court fuck up? Of course, when you fuck up and it works to your benefit, you can, as the late great prophet Bart Kopp, peace be upon him, once noted, when somebody fucks up and it works out well for them, expect them to continue fucking up in exactly the same way. And so here's the fuck up. It wasn't enough to, they could have just stopped and said, he's qualified to be on the ballot. He has to be on the ballot. And that would have been enough. But they decided to ask, to answer questions that were not asked of them. So first up, what originalism? Originalism is once again a giant, whopping, howling fraud, as it ever has been. It's just a malicious and cynical excuse by which they can work their will on the American people. Whether their will be that there be lots of guns in America and lots of children dead from them, or whether it be their will that women are reduced to sub-citizen status insofar as they have no control of the workings of their own bodies. I say they because I have no reproductive to control. But that's how they roll, as the kids say. And so they decided five gross old dudes who've decided that, the 14th Amendment only works in Section 3 if Congress does something about it. And the flaming barbed wire hoop jumping that was required for this is truly a thing to behold. Now, we have so many times gone over the language of Section 3, and we're going to do it again. Because we're going to be textualists. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of the president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, but Congress may, by a vote of two-thirds of each house, remove such disability. So the word vote is in Section 3 as regards congressional action. Otherwise, not shit in there about being on a ballot. Nothing. Not a sausage. Bopkus. But the means by which the disability is cured is there in the final sentence. But Congress may, by a vote of two-thirds of each house, remove such disability. Nothing in there about the mechanism by which a potential officer or resident or representative or senator or vice president, president would be prevented from taking office. So the Supreme Court of the United States, our most puissant dread sovereign supreme Catholic majesties under God, amen, decided to make one up. And they said, five of them said, okay, this is not the unanimous portion. Five of them said the only way to do that is for Congress to do it. That is bilious bullshit. that's why the prevailing opinion among many legal scholars was that Section 3 is self-executing. But how? Well, they answered by saying only Congress can do this. And that's what caused Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor to write separately in concurrence with not removing him from the ballot, but to say, this is some dipshittery. And then they quoted from Bush v. Gore, the dissent to Bush v. Gore, you know, to twist the knife a little bit. And the handmaid concurred in the concurrence. I know this gets a little confusing after a bit. The handmaid concurred in the concurrence, saying that she agreed that the majority fucked up by making up something out of whole cloth about Congress about Congress being able to impose the disability. But we don't even know what that mechanism looks like. Do we have to amend the Constitution again? But the handmaid did not outright join the other three women on the court because she said that they were being mean girls. They should have been more civil. They should have been more polite and ladylike. Bullshit. Bullshit. The three women who are actually decent lawyers and good and legal scholars were completely correct. And, you know, as we pointed out in the past, the Supreme Court of the United States fucks up about as often or more often than it gets things right. Plessy, Dred Scott, slaughterhouse cases, Lochner, to name but a few. And from those cases, what we remember is not the majority opinion, but the minority. And the first one that always comes to mind for me is is Justice Harlan's dissent. You should read it sometime in Plessy. It was withering. Another one that comes to mind is Justice Brennan's dissent in U.S. v. Leon, in which he just absolutely savages the majority for the judicial vandals that they are. So somehow or another, only the Congress, apparently, only the Congress can impose the disability, which means that if Nitwit Nero were to, God forbid and perish the thought, win in November, then Congress would have to act to refuse to allow him to become president. And FMD, if I know how they would do that. What it also means, now that we have it in hand, is that if he is to be removed, should he become president, Jack Smith needs to call the grand jury back in and present evidence to them of his engagement in the crime of insurrection, whatever that crime is. Billable Rick, you out there? Is there a federal insurrection statute handy? Steve in New York, if you're listening, help a girl out. It's designed to, you know, this is a case of delay, fail. So the reality is he's going to be on the ballot. I mean, who knows? He's in such peak physical shape. I mean, it's very unlikely that old 6'3" and 215 pounds in his bra is going to shuffle off this mortal coil between now and November. But the very real possibility does, it is, you know, what's the Bible say? Not a second is guaranteed. Something like that. They didn't have seconds back then. Not a day. I think they, not a day. But just to put it into the mix, Todd's prophecy could yet come true and have him, well, he ain't going to make it. Now, he's probably feeling fairly froggy right now, but he's still in a world of shit because, among other things, apparently, Judge Ngoron said that, Judge Kaplan said that Robbie Kaplan, counsel for E. Jean Carroll, can start what? Making preservations to take Nitwit Nero's shit away from him. So that's encouraging. Thank you, David. I should have mentioned you too. I'm so sorry. David, in Oregon, federal insurrection statute, 18 U.S.C.A. section 2383, rebellion or insurrection. Whoever incites, sets on foot, assists, or engages in any rebellion or insurrection against the authority of the United States or the laws thereof, or gives aid or comfort thereto, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both, and shall be incapable of holding any office under the United States. Well, there it is again. And I guess Congress would have to act in that regard, too. I need to see the actual language. But if Congress has to act in order to enforce any constitutional amendment, then why does the Supreme Court exist? One. Two. What does that say about other amendments? What if Congress has acted? Do they have to act again? Do we need to constantly reaffirm by congressional action that the 13th Amendment to the Constitution is still fucking valid? And what if, because this is just pure fantasy, what if Congress decided to act and say that in the absence of the word own in the Second Amendment, gun ownership is not legal? Oh, no, that's not that. No, not that. Do we see the inherent hypocrisy of this garbage? And David in South Carolina, Stan, pointing out states' rights. The states' rights argument has always been BS. Depends on what case the court's ruling on, whether it takes precedence. And you can see the little nullificationist wheels turning all over this country because they got their wish. The dog has caught the car. But I also want to, Flavio says, meanwhile, in France, on Monday, France became the first country in the world to enshrine abortion rights in its national constitution. On a 780 to 72 vote. Wow, that number, that margin. Lawmakers explicitly concluded that in Article 34, the law determines the conditions in which a woman has the guaranteed freedom to have recourse to an abortion. Women have had the right to abortion under French law since 1974. and none of the country's major political parties currently represented in parliament have questioned the essential right to abortion, but French feminist activists were prompted to cement legal protections after the United States Supreme Court in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health in 2022 overturned federal protection of U.S. abortion rights. Laura Slimani of the Fondation des Femmes rights group said, this right to abortion has retreated in the United States, and so nothing authorized us to think that France was exempt from this risk. And she added, there's a lot of emotion as a feminist activist, also as a woman. That margin, 780 to 72. What does that say about the ability of the religion dog to wag the governmental tail in France? Because the religion dog does all the wagging. The religion tail does all the wagging of the dog here in the greatest country in the history of the world on earth now today forever under in the universe under God. Amen. Hallelujah. Flavio also pointing out, if we're going to need enabling legislation for the Constitution to mean what it says, then we're going to need a lot of it for every item in there. What a joke. It's terrible reasoning. It's not even reasoning. And it will have terrible and pernicious effects going forward. And that's not an accident. Now, it's not entirely bad news, because there's stuff that isn't in the opinion that Nitwit Nero was praying all his most fervent prayers to see. He wanted the court to hold that he was not an officer of the United States and that therefore Section 3 was entirely inapplicable to him. They did not do that. They also did not say that he was not engaged in insurrection. So again, the door is open for Jack Smith to indict his sorry orange adipose ass. But he still has plenty of reason to worry. Now, I want to add into this. Oh, and by the way, I mean, it is a momentous day. So if any of y'all want to talk about this, or any of the legal eagles out there want to add clarity and perhaps competence to my own babblings, feel free to jump in, okay? I just wanted to get that out there in case anybody was chomping at the bit or anything. 844-843-4676, 844-THE-HORN. And then there's 304-574-8178. And then there's Skype to Robin Kincaid Horn. Robin, R-O-B-Y-N, Kincaid Horn, K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. And we can start discussifying. Cussing and discussing, as the intro to some guy named Bob says. So glad he's gone. But we can delve into it and just sort stuff out. But like I said, I wanted to add something to this discussion. One second. Hey, it's our buddy David. Let's check in with David. Hey, David.
Hi.
There you are. Or were.
Can you hear me?
Now I can.
Oh, I turned my mic off instead of on.
Oops.
Yeah, oops. So I'm in the middle of reading the opinion again for the second time. I was reading my con law reading for my Con Law 2 class this morning, and I saw the news come across the feed there, and I stopped what I was doing, and I read the opinion. My initial thoughts were that, oh, that kind of makes sense. The Constitution gives the authority to Congress to enforce the legislation. But the more I think about it, the more it doesn't make sense. And now that I've had the opportunity to discuss this with my con law professor, I've had the opportunity to discuss this with a judge on the Court of Appeals for the state of Oregon. And now I'm listening to you talk about it. And the more I think about it, the more chilled I am about this particular decision. I think they hit what they were aiming at, and that was the self-executing provisions of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, because they took that out behind the shed and used an axe handle on it.
Yeah, I think that this is going to be used as precedent, or at least reference, on their forthcoming attacks on any of the substantive due process protections of the 14th Amendment, and maybe even some of the incorporated rights of the Bill of Rights as they're incorporated to the states through the operation of the 14th Amendment.
Makes sense. Let me ask you a question. The problem isn't, it's almost redundant for the court to say Congress can act on this. Of course Congress can act on it.
They already have.
Well, there's that. But Congress could take further action. Congress could pass a law about insurrectionists and ballot act. Congress can do what Congress wants to do within the ambit of the Constitution. You know, they get an entire article all their own. maybe I'm being too obtuse about it, or flip.
No, I'm right there with you. So
the court didn't need to tell Congress that it had their mother may I for it.
Well, I mean, some of the justices on the Supreme Court probably believe that Congress needs to ask their permission to go to the bathroom.
I think you're right. But here's the thing. They tailored it too narrowly. That only Congress. So basically, they took themselves out of the argument.
That's the point I was trying to make to my con law professor earlier. I was like, does this mean that if Congress passes a definition of insurrection or rebellion that the court doesn't like, does that mean that the court no longer has the authority to define what insurrection or rebellion means in the context of the 14th Amendment? So, like, even in the statute that I sent you earlier, the criminal statute, there is, at least at the as quickly that I saw, I don't see any definition of insurrection or rebellion or any sort of test about how to apply those words or what actions.
Well, I don't know. It may be in the so oftentimes, David, in statutory schemes, the definitions are in another part of the code.
Yeah.
You know, insurrection shall be defined as. Treason shall be defined as. So maybe that's there, but and this is a really stupid, silly place to go to kind of further this argument. I don't know, and this is not me, you know, age shaming or anything. I don't know if you're old enough to remember the great flag burning kerfuffles of the 20th century.
I'm not.
Well, it's generally understood, and it still makes the little wing nuts absolutely bananas to say it, but burning a flag is political speech. It doesn't get much more political than that. burning an American flag.
Right.
And as such, it is protected. But there was a great debate in which legal minds said, yeah, it is, but Congress can pass a law that says it isn't, and Congress can pass a law taking jurisdiction to hear flag burning cases away from the Supreme Court.
Mm.
And they're not technically incorrect.
Right.
Congress can limit the jurisdiction of the courts. I mean, there are limitations, for instance, I'm sure you already know, if you, you know, there are jurisdictional limits on the damage amounts, the minimum damage amounts in federal civil suits.
Yeah, right.
And this just
75,000. Yeah, correctly.
Yeah. At one point, a much lower number, but they modify it from time to time based on the way, you know, on the valuation of a dollar. But this is, they've gutted themselves. It sure seems that way to me.
And yeah, I mean that's kind of how I was reading it too. But the Oregon appeals court judge that I was speaking with about this earlier, she was adamant about the point of that this is something that state courts do all the time. And that, are we saying now that state courts don't have the ability to interpret the Constitution when they're deciding cases in their jurisdiction?
You could interpret it that way.
So then, on the one hand, it could have the potential to limit the court's ability to define and to define what insurrection means within the context of the Constitution. But in another way, it also gives the Supreme Court more authority, as they would be the only arbiter, possibly, of what the Constitution means, and would take away that authority from the states.
I mean, this thing is, it's such a mess. Because they did say in the majority opinion, I scanned it, I didn't read it for like total depth of comprehension. just didn't have that kind of intestinal fortitude today. But they said, you know, the states can and do qualify who and remove from the ballot various individuals. And the first thing that came to mind for me was that case out of New Mexico, where you may recall an insurrectionist was booted either off the ballot or out of office. I think he was off the ballot for having participated in January the 6th. And it stuck. I think he was one of those assholes with, Cowboys for Trump. You remember that?
I don't, off the top of my head, no.
And so they seem to be saying that's perfectly legal.
Yeah, I mean, part of the opinion was that states could decide what insurrection meant within the meaning of the Constitution for their own state level officers.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they seem to me to be implicitly saying that the Colorado Supreme Court decision was incorrect, but then actually never got around to adjudicating the case on its merits.
Oh, they were running away from the merits as fast as they could go. So I have a question. as I said, I didn't see where they gave any mechanism by to define what that congressional action would be. You said you've read it once. You're reading it the second time. Have you found it yet?
I haven't. It just says that it is up to, from my reading of it, it says that the Congress is the correct venue to set forth the parameters and the adjudicative proceeding of deciding who has engaged in an insurrection and who hasn't. I'm assuming that is something that the Congress could just write a statute and confer that jurisdiction upon the federal courts. I think that might be the easiest way to go about this. But from my understanding of what I've read, and like I said, I'm reading it again just to confirm everything. What the court is saying is that the Congress is the correct venue to decide who gets to decide if someone engaged in an insurrection or not, and not the state courts.
Which leads me back to wherever the hell this is. I mean, I know we've got to be going in circles because I keep seeing empty boxes of Cheez-Its.
I don't understand. Like, I get that the court doesn't want to appear political, right? I mean,
Wait, did you just say that with a straight face?
I did, and I've just said an untrue thing. Now that I'm thinking.
Sorry, I mean, I'm not calling you out or anything, but.
Yeah, I guess that's just the law school indoctrination. I'm fighting against it tooth and nail, but sometimes it seeps through. But,
honey, you're gonna lose. I mean, please.
Thank you for pointing that out. You're right. That's an untrue statement that
But see, it's doing the same thing to me. Hold on. I saw my first jonquil blooming this weekend, and it made me so happy. And so green things are happening, and I'll be taking more of those pregnant sneezing pauses throughout the program, I'm certain. But it's moment things like this kind of move toward rendering me speechless.
It's baffling. I mean, on one hand, the court wants us to view them as the final adjudicative authority about what the Constitution means.
Marbury versus Madison. You've already been there, right?
Yeah, I have already been there. The court's ambit is to decide what the law is, right? But it is not going to say, or it's not prepared to say, or doesn't want to say, that the conduct that Donald Trump engaged in inciting his followers into attacking the Capitol building of the United States is an insurrection. I mean, we all have eyes. I saw that on the television. It damn sure looked like an insurrection. It's like pornography, right?
I can't tell you what it is, but I know it when I see it.
I know it when I see it. And I think I saw an insurrection that day, you know, but the Supreme Court doesn't want to say that it's an insurrection. And it also doesn't want to say that it's not an insurrection. It wants to say that, well, Congress should decide who has.
Congress can't decide what to put on a pizza.
Right. Right. And where we're at in our national dialogue, is Congress ever going to be able to come up with a viable plan for deciding who gets to decide what an insurrection looks like? Did Donald Trump perpetrate an insurrection? Are they saying that
Well, and it's see, I've got another thing. I've got another ingredient to add into our little cake batter here. There's another case that has been accepted by the Supreme Court that is going to potentially have a big impact on January 6th prosecutions, up to and including Nitwit Nero. And that is, an insurrectionist was charged and prosecuted and convicted in, of course, the D.C. federal court. The guy's name is Larry Brock. And he appealed his sentence to the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit has ruled, and it is now on its way to the Supreme Court. And this guy's a real dick. Sorry. You know, he's one of these guys that stormed the Capitol in combat gear, you know, Meal Team 6. So on March the 1st, this past Friday, the D.C. Circuit Court ordered a new trial for this guy. Because they said that the trial court improperly applied an enhancement to his sentence.
Okay, I saw the headline for this, but I didn't read the article.
Yeah, the enhancement was, and you know, for those who don't, you know, sentences can be, and you can, there are upward departures and downward departures in the federal system based upon factors within the conduct charged. And in this case, the enhancement stemmed from an allegation that Brock engaged in substantial interference with the administration of justice. And there are more than 100 other convictions where this enhancement was used. So that means 100 other cases where this ruling applies.
So then,
and the enhancement is how he wound up getting a, you know, wait for it, 2-year sentence in the federal joint.
Okay.
He was convicted on felony obstruction of an official proceeding and some misdemeanors. He is presently in the stir in Missouri and is due to get out in December. But this means more than 100 other cases similarly prosecuted are subject to review, and people whose cases have not yet been prosecuted cannot be thus enhanced upon conviction. And it even applies to Nitwit Nero. So basically what the 3-judge panel in D.C. said was Brock's interference with one stage of the Electoral College vote counting process, while no doubt endangering our democratic processes and temporarily derailing Congress's constitutional work, did not interfere with the administration of justice.
That's what I thought the argument would be.
And again, I'm not... if we're talking about the plain language of a statute and plain language doctrine, vote counting is not a matter of judicial administration.
Right.
It's not the counting of the vote, while a constitutionally mandated practice, it ain't in Article 3.
So it's not the administration of justice.
Right. Now, the next question is, who's the dipshit who thought that would be a good idea? You know, did this pass muster with Merrick the Meek?
I wouldn't know, but
you wouldn't be surprised.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, there are a lot of questionable decisions Merrick Garland has been making over the past few years that
I tried really hard to defend him because I felt like he deserved it. I'm done.
Yeah. I hate to say this, but the reason why we are in the position of Trump being able to delay these cases is because the prosecutions didn't start earlier. And I don't know why. It appears to me that Merrick Garland waited for the congressional investigation to be over before even substantively thinking about engaging in any sort of prosecutorial behavior.
And see, I think in that respect, David, I think it's important that we also bear in mind that there was a bit of disagreement between the DOJ and the House, the January 6th committee, particularly Chairman Benny Thompson, because the DOJ said, hey, give us all your shit right now. And the committee said, we will be happy to provide you with our findings once we're done.
Yeah.
And so that then, if you want to say enabled, that enabled Merrick the Meek to drag his heels. Because that's that much fewer time that the DOJ had with its hands on the actual evidence that they would use and take to a grand jury. See what I mean?
I do, but here's my thing. Why couldn't DOJ, in parallel to the congressional gathering of evidence, do their own investigation as well? That's not what I'm not comprehending. I don't understand why the Department of Justice had to wait for the congressional fact finders to finish their investigation before it could start its own fact finding. That's where my confusion comes in.
Well, it could have, and perhaps it did, but the problem was they kind of had to wait until the congressional action was over so that any indictment that they brought would not have potentially been in conflict with the findings of the House.
But there was never any, in my mind, there would have never been any authority for Congress to bring any sort of criminal charges anyway. It was more of like a truth and reconciliation type of deal, right, in the Congress. And so it was always going to rest with the Justice Department to bring charges for any criminal conduct.
Oh, it absolutely was, David. But if a defense counsel says, well, the House found this and this is your evidence and these two don't, you know, you can't make them line up, then that's, you know, one more little, brick in
the reasonable doubt thing.
Bingo.
Okay. That makes sense.
And so, in the case of this Brock asshole, it meant about 9 months extra on a sentence that the judge already lowballed.
Yeah. But I get your point, though, because like when I heard you read the enhancement, I was like, in my first thought was like, that doesn't sound like obstruction of administration of justice to me. But what do I know? You know? So I just don't understand how a trained attorney for the Justice Department would have brought that enhancement when I, as a law student, would have been hesitant to do so.
Fools rush in where angels fear to tread. and of course, this is also comical because the prosecutors wanted 5 years in prison.
And another thing that I can't quite reconcile with the prosecution of these dirty insurrectionists is, okay, so if a black person commits a crime in a state and a county or local prosecutor brings the charges, they're gonna throw every single charge that they can think of at the person. I don't see that happen. I don't see that happening with these dirty insurrectionists. I don't see the charges being stacked in the way they normally would be stacked against a black or brown defendant. And that's, I'm having trouble reconciling that.
Well, I mean, that's because the vast majority of the MAGA insurrectionists are, you know, the domestic terrorists, white folks. I mean, this particular clown, this John Brock, he was wearing a tactical flak vest, you know, with the ceramic plates that go in it.
Yeah.
And like a tank driver's helmet.
He was in full battle regalia.
Yeah, Feldgrau camo jacket. And he was down on the floor of the house. And of course, he's got his Punisher skull on his flak jacket.
But that's not an insurrection or rebellion. That's not a seditious conspiracy. What was he charged with?
He was charged with obstruction of an official proceeding.
That was the enhancement.
No.
Oh, that was the charge.
Yeah.
That was the charge.
Yeah, that was the felony.
Oh, okay.
I guess because we just didn't have the stomach to call domestic terrorists or, you know, God forbid, insurrectionists.
And see, I'm having trouble reconciling that, given what I've learned about how.
Well, I've been howling for months about the kid gloves treatment these terrorists have been receiving.
Yeah, terrorists. I think that's a good word.
And even the big sentences for, who's the 3%er? The you'll shoot your eye out, kid. And then he did.
I want to say Bundy, but that's not the right.
No,
the
white supremacist. No. And of course, Enrique Tarrio, the Proud Boys, they're both doing long. They're doing long hard time, but it should have been longer.
Yeah.
And longer was available to the sentencing judge. But somehow, you know, just couldn't quite bring themselves to throw the book at people who tried to overturn the government of the United States.
I'm having trouble squaring that. I really
am. Well, you're having trouble squaring it because it's not squarable.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You're looking at a circle and can't do it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so this, and it gives me, it, I don't want to think this, but I do. I feel like even though they didn't give Nitwit Nero what he wanted, I feel like it's pretty obvious that there is an inclination to do exactly that.
I think so too. I mean, looking at who benefits from this decision today, I mean, there's the forces of democracy and, you know, civilization don't benefit from this particular decision.
I don't ever want to hear anybody refer to John Roberts as an institutionalist ever again. You know,
right.
none of these bow-tied, foulard-wearing pontificators who show up on cable news shows. Don't tell me he's an, because if he was an institutionalist, he would have protected the institution today.
Yeah.
He did not. He was a willing accomplice to the gutting.
Maybe he's rationalizing this decision as like, well, at least I didn't say that Donald Trump didn't do, at least I didn't say Donald Trump did not do an insurrection. So that keeps us, as the Supreme Court, above the fray. We didn't say yes, he did an insurrection. We didn't say no, he didn't do an insurrection. So that preserves the institution. I'm wondering if that's how he's rationalizing this. I'll never know.
It's just my opinion, but I don't think he is.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think he's not who they thought he was. Dim leader specifically nominated him to be Chief Justice because he was supposedly such an institutionalist.
Is John Roberts one of those Federalist Society?
Of course.
Leo Leonard picks?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that fits.
And they've created, unless I'm entirely wrong, they have created just a world of problems. They might as well have overruled Marbury.
Right. I mean, this is. I mean, I think the concurrence, Sotomayor, Kagan's, and Jackson's concurrence, quotes Marbury versus Madison.
And Bush v. Gore.
And this court is authorized to say what the law is only because those who apply a rule to a particular case must of necessity expound and interpret that rule. So I don't get why. I mean, I guess I don't get why this wasn't a dissent from Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson.
Well, because they were concurring in it should have been concurring in part and dissenting in part, but they established the terms. You know, it was a concurrence insofar as the ballot question. Everything else was dissent. And see, here's the thing. They had four votes. If Roberts was truly an institutionalist, all he had to do was join in with the ladies.
Right.
And I think they would have had a more narrowly tailored result.
That's a really, really good point.
And, you know, and the fascists could have pounded sand.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
But something made him side with his god emperor. At least in terms of ballot access. But they didn't say he's not an insurrectionist.
They didn't say that. Right. But they have the majority opinion have the per curiam decision, I should say, heavily implies that. It heavily implies that what Colorado did was incorrect. And it leaves open the possibility of Trump doing what Trump does and saying that that's what they said.
And historically, one of the things I don't necessarily understand, I mean, I'm certainly not magisterial on the topic, but Section 3 operated with self-execution to an extent in the aftermath of the Civil War.
Right.
You know, Robert E. Lee's citizenship was only returned to him posthumously like in the 1970s.
I didn't know that, but that squares.
And I don't think there was any... And he understood he could never go back. But by the same token, it seems obvious that the Congress did act to cure the disability for some others, inasmuch as, just one that comes immediately to mind, fighting Joe Wheeler, He was a cavalry officer for the Confederacy. He was also an officer of the United States Army in the Spanish-American War, I think in Cuba. So his disability had to be cured. So too with James Longstreet. That's the man that Lee called his old war horse.
Okay.
And he would go on to put down the insurrection in New Orleans in the aftermath of the Civil War as a member of the United States military. So there we are.
Yeah.
I mean, Congress has acted in the past within the ambit of Section 3, the final sentence that begins with but. They've done that. But Congress, to the best of my knowledge, had never acted in the contrary. They never took action to say that someone was ineligible, either to be... And again, there's nothing about elections, there's nothing about ballots, but I'm not aware of Congress taking action to say that someone could not hold office post-insurrection because Section 3 does not require them so to do. And that's what makes this thing such a damn conundrum.
Yeah. I do get it, right? I say that I don't understand. But that I think there's more accurate language that I could use here, right? I get that what they're doing is supporting Trump without being able to, without being accused of supporting, without being seen as supporting Trump, or what they, or I'm struggling with my words right now because it just doesn't, I get what they're doing, right? But from the standpoint of like continued constitutional governance in the United States, it doesn't make any rational sense unless your goal, or one's goal, I should say, is to end constitutional governance in the United States. Is what I'm saying making any sense whatsoever?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
So when I say I don't understand, I'm saying that in the sense that I don't, it doesn't make sense in the context of perpetuating constitutional governance. And the only way it does is if one does not want to perpetuate the continuance of constitutional governance in the United States.
And I think there's elements of that. And so in one of the articles that I read, David, there was a remark that the reason to have a written constitution, because, of course, you know, Mary Oldie Engelon doesn't have one. The reason to have a written constitution is because that constitution can operate in the absence of proper governance. That constitution can operate even if government has fallen into unconstitutional hands.
Yeah.
And this appears to undo that. Now, I just got a note from Darlene in Connecticut. The DOJ didn't investigate separately so as to not find evidence in conflict with the J6 committee? Seriously, Roxanne? You're stretching the rubber band to the point of breakage. Garland would have loved contra evidence. Constructive critique here. You were inconsistent. You pilloried Robert Mueller because you said he's a Republican and Republicans would never indict one of their own, another particularly a Republican president. Yet Garland is an independent. Somehow he deserved the benefit of the doubt. Seriously? We all know independents are just disaffected Republicans, and I'll add, who want to smoke dope. And if Garland, no, that's libertarians. And if Garland truly wanted to appear apolitical, then he would have been registered as unaffiliated. You cut him more slack than he deserved because Biden made the mistake of selecting him in the first place. You may be right, Darlene. I may have been wrong about him all along. I thought that his tenure on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals would stand him in good stead. And instead, it has made him as cautious as a member of the judiciary sitting in a law enforcement job. So, what? Yeah.
And there's
Steve in New York points out, I wonder if this is a horse trade for ruling against Trump in the immunity case, because we've pointed out in the past that a lot there, you know, there's a lot of horse trading going on. In the last term, we saw it with the Alabama redistricting ruling. And I said, this is horse trading for some kind of evil that they're going to do later. And it was. And I said that they did that because they knew that it wasn't going to turn Alabama blue or even purple. And so it looked like tit for tat, but it effectively just allowed them to have have a fig leaf to cover for other of their evil. Oh, and I did make one mistake. The Brock case is not on the way to the Supreme Court. Another case that centers on the obstruction of the administration of justice enhancement is already there. They will hear the SCOTUS will hear arguments on that next month. And the only thing that's clear to me coming out of this is that Jack Smith had better get that grand jury back in there and charge this fucker with insurrection.
I mean, arguably, the Congress has already acted, right? It just takes DOJ enforcement of that action. I'm with you on that, you know? And to your point about self-execution, I know everybody's emotions are probably running high right now, given the stakes of the election and the ramification upon those stakes of this decision. But let's say for the sake of argument that Joe Biden is going to win in November, and we get the House and the Senate, right? So operating under that assumption, we are still left with this decision and this court in dealing with how this particular decision affects the 14th Amendment protections in the other sections of the 14th Amendment. Equal protection, due process.
Precisely.
All of the protections incorporated to the states.
I'm so proud of you.
Through due process. Oh, that's my first cowbell ever.
Was it really?
Yeah.
So no, I am, because you just connected the dots and tied it in a pretty little bow. Because remember the concurrence of Fappy Thomas in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. Bring me cases to overturn Bostock and Obergefell and Lawrence with.
Right.
Because, he said, I want to revisit and be done with the concept of substantive due process, which is a child of the 14th Amendment.
And it's a self-executing child of the 14th Amendment.
Oh, yes,
right?
It is.
So that means there's no congressional there's no congressional action needed to someone for someone to assert the protection of those rights. And so if they're going to take this decision and say that congressional action is needed for all of the 14th Amendment because Section 5 says that Congress is the only one with the authority to enforce these other sections of the 14th Amendment, then that gives Thomas and Alito the ammunition that they need to overturn everything else. And yeah, that's what I'm concerned about.
As you should be. It's terrifying.
Which is why I don't get why Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson did not at least dissent in part to this.
Nor I. It's a fair question to ask, but the thing is, short of them telling us, and maybe it's tucked away in the concurrence, short of them telling us themselves, it's just going to be about if the multimillionaire for-profit media ever gets around to even asking David, it's going to be a matter of so-called pundits and so-called experts sitting around reading tea leaves.
So it is addressed in the concurrence. I'll just read a part of it if I could.
Okay, please.
To start, nothing in Section 3's text supports the majority's view of how federal disqualification efforts must operate. Section 3 states simply that no person shall hold certain positions and offices if they are oath-breaking insurrectionists. Nothing in that unequivocal bar suggests that implementing legislation enacted under Section 5 is critical, or for that matter, what that word means in this context. In fact, the text cuts the opposite way. Section 3 provides that when an oath-breaking insurrectionist is disqualified, Congress may, by a vote of two-thirds of each House, remove such disability. It is hard to understand why the Constitution would require a congressional supermajority to remove a disqualification if a simple majority could nullify Section 3's operation by repealing or declining to pass implementing legislation. Even petitioner's lawyer acknowledged the tension in Section 3 that the majority view creates. Similarly, nothing else in the rest of the 14th Amendment supports the majority's view. Section 5 gives Congress the power to enforce the amendment by appropriate legislation. Remedial legislation of any kind, however, is not required. All the Reconstruction amendments, including the due process and equal protection guarantees and prohibition of slavery, are self-executing, meaning they do not depend on legislation. Similarly, other constitutional rules of disqualifications, like the two-term limit on the presidency, and do not require implementing legislation. Nor does the majority suggest otherwise. So they do address it in the concurrence, but I just don't understand why it's not labeled as a dissent, because that sounds like a dissent to me.
And that sounds like a legitimate Supreme Court opinion. That's not cynical Machiavellian ends based decision making. That's not a reverse engineered decision.
Right.
Apparently, we've got to clear up some issues here. Ron and Raleigh chiding me. Once again on Merrick Garland, told you so. Yes, you did. And, you know, I don't have any problem saying I was wrong in my judgment of someone. Our buddy Gary, labor man out in New Mexico, he said, you're confusing me. It was a 9-0 ruling, so what's the big deal? What was the argument made by the plaintiff's lawyers before the Supreme Court during arguments, and what was the question being addressed by the Supreme Court? Well, it's a big deal because only a teeny tiny little portion of it, Gary, is 9-0. And that is the simple question: can Colorado remove him from the ballot or ban him from the ballot? And since Section 3 of the 14th Amendment doesn't refer to elections or ballots, the answer was simply no, they cannot. If it had all stopped there, we'd be okay. the conversation we're having now is about the ruling that the Supreme Court decided to add into the mix that only the Congress can make Section 3 work, that it is not, in fact, self-actualizing, self-executing. That in order to bar someone from being on the ballot, Congress has to do that. So that presumably they would be doing so on a national level and not piecemeal state by state. I agree with saying that he can't be taken off the ballot. But everything else, no. Not just no, but hell no. The court effectively took the... I mean, David, work with me here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the... I mean, the entire reason why I called in was because of the ramifications of the rest of the decision, right? The way that these manipulative Supreme Court justices, I was going to use a harsher word, but I decided against it. The way that these manipulative Supreme Court justices can use the language in this opinion to attack other substantive rights that people have come to enjoy is what is causing such alarm for me. And I'm willing to bet is what's causing such alarm for Roxanne.
Well, it is. And my mind has been a whirl ever since this happened, ever since this came out, because I started reading and I just had my little head in my little hands going, what? I mean, Sarah, get Juanita on the line down to the Bluebird Diner, for God's sakes. I need pie. But if Section 3 can only be triggered by the action of the Congress, and I thought the concurrence stated it perfectly, the legal reasoning, the rationale was rock solid. But in the majority's opinion, if only Congress can trigger Section 3 in regard to an insurrectionist, then what happens to actually trying someone for insurrection? I mean, the rational statement would be to say that, well, Congress has already acted insofar as Congress passed an insurrection statute, and therefore it can be charged via an indictment and tried in the federal court system. But I don't trust these clowns to even agree to that. Do you?
I don't. And on top of that, there's nothing in the 14th Amendment that says that the only way to attach a disability for an insurrection is through criminal proceeding.
Yeah. And I don't know. Section 3 is so clear. It's as clear as an amendment can be drawn.
I agree.
And it says you can't do that. So it means you're not even supposed to try. So what happens when somebody tries? Well, I can't do anything about it.
Right. And what is the proper venue or avenue to bring such a disability claim, right? So say someone we're here now. Say someone that has a credible accusation of being involved in an insurrection or supporting an insurrection in some way, and then wants to run for office, but has not been charged or convicted of an insurrection. How does one bring an action to disqualify that person from the ballot, the decision doesn't say. That all the decision says is it's up to Congress to decide that.
No.
But in the absence of a congressional action, do we just not have a way to do that right now? I mean, the way that
You're in the same place I am, David. Oh, and by the way, let me mention, we're past the halfway point of the program. We had $300 to raise this evening. We still have $300 to raise if anybody wants to. I don't think you're going to get analysis like this good anywhere else. What could happen, what should happen, if we had a Congress that ran according to their oaths and not according to their politics, is a bill should be, an identical bill should be introduced in both houses of Congress, declaring that Donald Trump is an insurrectionist, and that should he win the election, he is and will be forever barred from holding office.
Is that something, do you think, that the Congress can do by concurrent resolution? Is that something, or does that something that needs, and I'm not sure if I'm using the right word, or is that something that needs to be, that needs to go to the president for his signature?
Oh, I think the Supremes just said only Congress. So it sounds to me like concurrent resolution. Now, if they did it by concurrent resolution without the president's signature, it would then go to the Supreme Court and they'd say, no, the president has to sign it, too.
And then Donald Trump would say, see, I told you they just want to keep me off the ballot.
And I do want to keep him off the ballot. Anyone else with a shred of common dignity wouldn't have even filed. And here's the thing. This is where I'm personally conflicted. I don't want him to be president. I don't think he should be on the ballot, but I want the fucker to be their nominee. Because I want to beat him a third time. I want to hit him again and put a little stank on it this time. It's not enough to beat him. He must be humiliated and driven from public life.
Right, because we still have the problem of his followers. Even if he does,
right, if we had the ancient Roman concept, and it's Egyptian too, and I suspect throughout the ancient world, if we had the Latin concept of damnatio memoriae, I would want to do that too. Erase his name, erase everything he did from history, and even go so far as invalidate the laws that he signed into being. Make it as though he never were.
Oh, I like that idea. Bye-bye tax cuts.
Yeah, bye-bye trillionaire tax. Billionaire tax cut. See ya.
All that history book learning is definitely going to come in handy, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the Romans did. Well, I mentioned the Egyptians. Yeah, because we can't do this without going into ancient history now, can we? In the aftermath, the coup of the pharaoh's name? He's the one who looks like Obama.
It's really Akhenaten.
Akhenaten, yes. Thank you. I said looks like Obama, and you immediately said Akhenaten. Because he does. It's wild.
Weird. Yeah.
But in the aftermath of his rule, they restored the old religion and damnatio memoriae'd him. They chiseled his face off of his name, everything, the hieroglyphs, what have you. And those stelae exist to this day. And you can see where they erased him from their history. The fact that we know about Akhenaten means that they didn't do a good enough job of it, but you know, we file this under the at least they tried. Sulla in the Roman Republic in his dictatorship did the same thing to Gaius Marius and took down all of his statues that referred to him as the common savior of humanity.
Oh, so he was a humble man.
Well, he came from humble beginnings, and yeah, you know,
that was a joke.
I know. but that was a standard, you know. The Middle East was littered with statues of Pompeius Magnus and Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great, and they all bore the proclamation, "Common Savior of Humanity." Yeah, Messiah's cropped up there every other day. You the Messiah? I am today. What are you going to do about it?
Oh, my goodness.
By the way, Matt wrote in from San Francisco. The Supremes, the problem I have with the court is that six of them are not honest brokers. They lied to get confirmed. Mitch Bitch changed the 60-vote threshold in order to put the wackos on the court. That he did. As far as I'm concerned, it's an illegitimate court, which is why trying to make sense of their rulings is so mind-bending. To me, it's just easier to say it's just another bullshit opinion from the corrupt court. In order to save this democratic republic, we need to address the corruption of the court. Bring the head count to 13, or impeach all of the corrupt ones and replace them. I know this is pie in the sky, but I don't see it getting better in its current form. And, Matt, it's not gonna. I mean...
And the issue with that I'm seeing too is like there are those of us who kind of have to, unfortunately, who kind of have to reason our way through what they're saying so that we can craft arguments to beat them back. Does that make sense?
Yes. And and based on what I read and what you've read, I think the concurrence of the three is part of that.
I do too. What I'm struggling to reconcile is why give them the ammunition of being able to go to the press and claim, and this is political, this is a political argument, but why give them that ammunition to go to the press and claim that this was a unanimous decision, because most people aren't going to sit here and read the opinion and the concurrence, or sit here and listen to a podcast of people discussing the opinion and the concurrence for a couple of hours. Most people aren't going to do that. They're going to see the headline and they're going to say, "Oh well, the Supreme Court unanimously decided that Donald Trump can be on the ballot. Must mean that he didn't do an insurrection." And they're not going to go any further than that. So I don't get why. I mean, these are not stupid people, right? The three ladies on our side on the Supreme Court, they're in fact brilliant. And so I don't
get why. They're the smartest of the lot.
Right. So I don't get why they would give them this sort of ammunition. And that's where I'm trying to figure out what the horse trading is, because I do recall that conversation that you had about the horse trading. I listened to that podcast that day. And so could it be that they agreed to have a unanimous opinion so that an even worse, more awful majority opinion wasn't written for this case?
Well, anytime you get a Supreme Court ruling, you know that it is the ruling that is the least shitty they could come up with when it's this bunch.
Yeah.
The fact that the handmaid chided the other three women for being, she tone policed them and said that they were too mean, and the court needed to be unifying America, not dividing it. Bitch, please. No, I mean.
But she still
concurred with them in the substance of their argument.
The tone deafness of that. The Supreme Court needs to be unifying in its presence, or whatever the hell kind of nonsense she said. That is devoid or divorced from reality. I mean, the Supreme Court is nothing but divisive at this point in our political discourse. And this decision, even though it's per curiam, doesn't make that any less so. Not in my view.
I don't think so either. And Gary says, I'm still confused. Do I have this correct? The case was Trump versus Colorado. Well, it's technically Donald J. Trump petitioner versus Norma Anderson et al. And did Colorado argue for the Supreme Court to decide Trump is an insurrectionist? Not as such, Gary. The Supreme Court of Colorado said he is an insurrectionist. And the Supreme Court of the United States refused to address the question. The only question they asked or answered was, can a state move unilaterally to remove a presidential candidate from the ballot? But having answered, all nine having answered that question in the negative, five members of the court went forward and decided to, while not saying he's not an insurrectionist, and while not saying he's immune, and while not agreeing with any of his other arguments, they did say only Congress can make Section 3 of the 14th Amendment do anything. You know, as if Section 3 is a pair of roller skates and only Congress has the key. Wow, is that a dated reference? So, I mean, the only real answer is to go and read the damn thing.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, it's not light reading, and in point of fact, it's infuriating reading. These days I wait to see what Ketanji Brown Jackson, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan have to say. But it tells it. But I think it also tells us how close this the next case could be, since we were talking about horse trading.
Mm-hmm. The next case is the immunity. Are we on the same page there?
It will be argued on the 22nd.
Okay.
I think it was Neil Katyal who said, the Supreme Court took 25 days to reach this decision. If they take even a day longer, it will be a manifest injustice in deciding the and again, I feel like the immunity case is a no-brainer.
And
but it isn't. Is he immune for shit he did as a candidate? No. But the what is it, the 29 words of how the Supreme Court framed what they will decide, that could get messy.
The whole official acts business.
Yes.
Yeah. On that point, I'm sorry. Did you have something else? I'm sorry.
Please. I mean, I've got more to say, but go.
On that point about the official acts thing, right? What I can't wrap my head around is how, if they're going to rule that the president has some sort of immunity against or for official acts, quote unquote, in my mind, there is in no world an official act of the president that is not authorized by law. Meaning, if it's illegal to begin with, it cannot be an official act of the presidency, because all of the president's powers are vested in the president by law. So if the president
by the Constitution.
Acts by the Constitution, so if the president acts outside of that authority or outside of the law, then how on earth can that act be an official act? So why would he need criminal immunity for an official act, for an act that is not official to begin with?
I think you're right. I think you're writing the opinion right now. Because see, the obverse to this coin is what Nixon said long ago. Well, he was talking to David Frost.
Well, David, if the president does it, it's not illegal.
So that absolved him of the bombing of Cambodia and Laos. That absolved him of the cover up for Watergate. And of course, we know that his successor, Gerald Ford, did not believe that to be true because he gave him a prospective pardon. It was a pardon for shit that he did that he hadn't even been charged with, or any other charges. And even that was probably illegal. How can you pardon someone for something that they haven't been charged with? How can you pardon something for a crime of which they have not been convicted?
Right.
I'm sorry. I mean,
you made my brain seize for a moment. Sorry, I apologize.
Welcome to my world. It's mind-boggling. And the potential mischief to come out of this, you know, it was, what, two summers ago now that Dobbs came out and Bruin came out and have upended jurisprudence in this country with this notion that the Supreme Court says that everything that we do now has to be predicated upon the history and traditions of the United States.
Some of that history and tradition being absolutely awful.
Right, and some of that history and tradition being just whatever they want it to be, whatever they need to make up at the time. You know, they overturned Roe saying that abortion wasn't part of the history and tradition of the United States, and that is merely because for the vast majority of the history of this country, the history has been written by men who were not there when women were aborting pregnancies. Because that's one of those things that you don't talk about the boys with, because they will not understand. It's none of their business. It's not their body. And women from time immemorial have kept men out of their business because they knew that if men, you know, it's the whole camel's nose under the tent thing. Because once the camel's nose is under the tent, you're going to get the hump. And then you've got a camel in the tent. and within a paternalistic system, there's no way that men, because you know they get all tied up in, well, you know, that's my progeny and stupid shit like when the king dies, the queen has to wait 9 months to make sure there's not a little heir growing in there. H-E-I-R, heir. It's, but now everything, and the same thing with Bruin, where you can't have a gun law in this country if it's not steeped in the history and traditions of the United States, but that doesn't apply to making sure that everything, you know, anybody who carries a gun loads it by the muzzle.
And like you imply, the history and tradition of that seems to be rooted in bailment, which is not something that this Supreme Court's going to be, is primed to recognize.
Right, and were that argument to be made, they would not accept it, but they would not be able to legitimately refute it either.
Right. And on that history and tradition point, there was a fantastic article in Politico that came out at the time from a history and law professor, I forget her name, but it was in Politico, and it was about the history that Alito got egregiously wrong. When he decided, or when the court decided Dobbs.
Yeah, I mean, it was nothing. Look, dude was citing to the Salem witch trials, for Christ's sakes. Okay?
Yeah.
Emilio said the court doesn't want to be labeled as so nakedly and bluntly helping Trump. I think there's an element of that. Darlene in Connecticut says, wonderful convo with David. Right on, Matt. Truthfully, I've been having queasy feelings in my stomach about the three ladies on SCOTUS. There must be something in the drinking water at the U.S. Supreme Court building, or they're all hiding hip flasks of rock gut tequila under those black robes. Don't kid yourselves. They all lobbied to get noticed for appointments to the Supreme Court, including Sotomayor, Kagan, and KBJ. They were screaming at the top of their lungs to get picked. With Sonia and her book deals and sticking up for Gorsuch despite him trying to kill her by refusing to wear a mask. KBJ and her harping on the lack of the word president in the 14th, Section 3, and completely ignoring the congressional record when the bill was being debated. Wait, let me state that again. Hello, ignoring the congressional record in order to make another rancid decision designed to psychologically abuse us again and again. Elena, well, I've never been overly impressed. I think there's some Stockholm syndrome going on with them. It's in the Kool-Aid. And Darlene, I've made the argument in the past that there is no such thing as a liberal Supreme Court justice. And I think I first enunciated that back when there was a 9-0 decision saying that it was unconstitutional to keep toxic grannies away from abortion clinics and keeping them from being able to wave their gross posters with the vivisected fetuses on it from people, you know, from women who are just going in for a mammogram or a pap smear, or going for an abortion for that matter. And the hypocrisy of that was stunning. Massachusetts later went back and corrected the statute, but the hypocrisy was stunning in as much as they made that decision, that 9-0 decision, that a woman who is simply exercising her absolute right to take care of her body is not protected against anti-abortion protesters, but they issued that decision from behind, you know, practically a quarter-mile barrier that they, the Supreme Court, themselves have. There is hypocrisy there. But still, they're the best three we've got. And, you know, if they want to sing a little, if they want to sing a chorus of Kumbaya with the handmaid, I don't know. Maybe they can corrupt her. Maybe she's getting a little taste of freedom and she doesn't have to ask daddy all the time whether or not she can make a decision. Wouldn't that be wild? Steve in New York says, presidential acts. The president has war prosecuting, not war making power. Could a grand jury charge a president with war crimes committed in the context of the power of the Constitution authorizes? Well, I was thinking about George W. Bush in particular with all of this. It is an illegal war founded upon lies that costs untold billions, if not trillions, and takes the lives of a million innocents. So he couldn't be tried for that, I guess.
If they were to recognize some sort of immunity for official acts, I'm assuming that would fall within that holding. I do.
I do too. And that seems insane.
And here's another hypothetical, right? Completely consistent, as I understand the war. As I understand the War Powers Act, to give the president authorization to launch the attack that took out bin Laden, right? I'm not entirely certain if President Obama was I'm not entirely certain if he got congressional approval outside of just notifying the Gang of Eight before that particular attack happened. I don't think it was something that was debated on the floor and authorized, right? So I think he undertook that under the War Powers Act. I could be wrong, obviously. But on this hypothetical, say a future president launches a Navy SEAL attack on a foreign leader, right? A leader of a foreign country. Is that official act of the president covered under this immunity? And what happens to congressional authority to declare war when the when that hypothetical future president has just assassinated the leader of a country? Is that official act immune from prosecution? I mean, these are the kind of constitutional crisis questions.
And that's where the drill down is going to come. If it's illegal ab initio, is it official?
And I would say no. If it's not within the law, it is not within the outer perimeter of the president's power. Which is, I think, a quote from the Nixon case that you referenced earlier.
Yeah. But if the question is that narrowly tailored, yes, then they answer it. Yes, the president has immunity for official acts, and maybe even qualifies it, official acts that are legal from the first place. Then that really doesn't do much relative to, I mean, it's no help. It's no help to Judge Chutkan.
But why on earth would someone need immunity from a legal act? From a legal act, not an illegal act. But if was legal to begin with, why would they need immunity in the first place? Because the only issue, I guess, is if there's some question about the legality of a presidential action.
Yeah, like starting an illegal war.
Right.
Or trying to shake down the president of a foreign country.
Which is what Trump stands accused of.
Well, that's what he was impeached for the first time.
Right.
Or inciting an insurrection. And he's going to try to argue that he did that as an official act, when I think it's going to be abundantly clear that that was an act of candidate Trump, even though he had already lost.
I can hear your exasperation.
I don't like what any of this is.
Right.
This is something they have made a mess, and we're going to pay for it. Now, I just got another note from labor man Gary. So they told us something we've always known. Congress can make any law about any section or amendment to the Constitution. Again, this is no big deal. I, too, did not agree with any state removing anyone from a state ballot. We here in New Mexico did not remove anyone from a ballot. We tossed a cowboy out of office. I think that's what happened, but I'll check into that to try and verify. It seems to me it was the sheriff of Otero County that was removed from office. I think that's the case. Ralph's looked it up for me earlier. Yeah, he was the title barred from office over January 6th. A New Mexico judge removed Coy Griffin as a commissioner of Otero County, citing the 14th Amendment's clause barring officials who've engaged in insurrection or rebellion from holding public office. And if I read the opinion correctly today, the Supreme Court said, "Yup, you can do that."
That's my reading as well.
As to the other part of what Laborman said is, no, it is a big deal, because they didn't just say Congress can do that. They said only Congress can do that.
Right.
So even though she's clothed with all the majesty of Article 3 of the Constitution, lifetime appointment to the court, on the bench, what have you, a sitting federal judge can't do that now, according to this ruling. And that's what they said, David.
That's exactly what they said. That's what they said. Yeah. I wouldn't have thought to put it in terms like that, but that's exactly what they said. Yes.
Of course Congress can do what Congress wants to do. It has to be constitutional. Marbury versus Madison says the final arbiter of constitutionality is the Supreme Court. But in this case, they've turned around and said that the final arbiter, the final interpreter of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, is the fucking Congress. And that is just cuckoo bananas.
It is. But a remedy for this, right, if Congress was so disposed to initiate a remedy for this, would be Congress passing a bill that provides jurisdiction to Article III courts to adjudicate insurrection cases. If that's what the Supreme Court is saying that Congress needs to do.
But based on this ruling, wouldn't the Supreme Court turn around and say that's unconstitutional because we said only Congress can do it? And you're delegating a congressional power improperly to the judicial branch? I mean, my little law school ruined brain is going all over the places here. This could turn.
It's bad. This is all bad. We are like the Oregon appellate court judge that I was talking to about this earlier today was like, we are in the midst of a constitutional crisis, but nobody is really talking about it. And we're not talking about it in law school. We're not talking about anything in law. So we're not talking about this in law. We had a 15-minute discussion in my Con Law 2 class earlier today, and that's because I kept bringing up points. Like, I think...
Oh, you're that law student.
I'm that.
Hated people like you. I just want to get out of here.
I'm that guy. Yeah, I'm that guy.
I'm kidding. But, I was.
But that's something that I wanted to bring up too. Like, law school, from going through it currently, law school is definitely about conditioning one to accept the way the system is, to accept the status quo without question. And so one of the tools that's necessary to maintain some semblance of free thought, I guess, I'm exaggerating, but a little bit, kind of, in law school is to just keep that distrust of the system, because it seems like a lot of us are not trusting the Supreme Court for good reason. But
their approval rating is in the toilet.
Right, but it seems like the three justices who were appointed by Democrats, I'll put it that way, on the court are still operating from a place of trust in the system that was inculcated into them in law school.
And you know, I see a lot of complaints from people talking about the court of it. Micah asked the other day, when are the Democrats going to realize that the genteel rules by which they insist upon playing are not in use by everyone and are going to result in their own harm and in harm to a lot of Americans? And there's validity in that argument, but by the same token, if we all just decide to go down that road, there's no coming back from it.
Right.
I mean, I thought it was valuable. When I was in law school, we had a visiting professor who his focus was primarily labor, but he was a Marxist legal theorist. And he was fascinating to listen to because he was doing the exact opposite of what you just described. He was saying, don't accept the status quo. Don't accept that it's always this way and always been this way and will always be this way, because it won't. It can't. These are systems that evolve. The legal system of the United States is not, no matter how desperately they want it to be, these maggots on the court, the legal system of the United States is not the same thing that it was in 1787.
Right. I mean, wholeheartedly agree. I wholeheartedly agree with that.
I mean, it's not I'll tell you frankly, it's not the same practice that it was 24, 25 years ago. I mean, the simple, and it's not simple, but the addition of the internet and electronic filing into the system has, you know, I mean, it's just as simple. When I filed my name change petition, I did what I was taught to do. I took an original and three copies with me. And she said, oh, we only need the first one, and scanned it in, and that was it. And I said, well, can I have a certified copy? Oh, well, if you want one, I get. We still do that? Yeah, we still do that.
So you brought everything literally in triplicate?
Yes. Yeah, I was raised right, and I was learnt, and I was learnt real good.
But I think the point that
I think
trying...
it's hilarious. I think it's charming that you think that's quaint and cute.
I do. I think the point that I'm trying to make is that
did you like write on stuff with things? I mean, were there pens involved? There's vellum? Did you have to put sand on the ink to get it to dry and blow on it after you'd written on it? Do you use an old-timer knife to sharpen your turkey quill, Roxanne?
I think the point that I'm trying to make is that none of those changes came about by people trusting the way that the system operated at the time, right?
Yeah.
And so...
Well, that's my whole Tinkerbell theory of the Constitution. The Constitution, you know, Tinkerbell, when Tinkerbell's dying in Peter Pan, the only way she can live is if everybody claps for her, or is if everybody believes in her and shows that belief, demonstrates that belief by clapping for her. And yeah. If we don't all believe in the Constitution, if we don't manifest that belief in maintaining an order, an ordered system of laws and not personages, Tinkerbell fucking dies.
Yeah.
And that's what the maggots are about these days. They want Tinkerbell dead.
Which is the only way to interpret these decisions in a way that makes any sense.
Well,
it's the only frame.
And I think these assholes, you know, these assholes are in large part, you know, they're Federalist societies and whatnot. But what they're doing is they are creating their libertarian wonderland. The cases that are before the court in this term are, as they seem always to be lately, harrowing. Because the majority in this court only takes cases that they want to see win. Think about 303 Creative.
Mm-hmm.
The court sat there knowing full well that that tax-exempt Christian grift law office, the Alliance of Demeaning Freedom, had created a potential customer of their client out of whole cloth who had no reality in life. And they just gave the person a random name when they contacted them, they said, what? I'm not gay. I'm straight. I'm married to a woman. I've never heard of these people. I've never heard of 303 Creative. I certainly don't need a wedding website. And the court said, ho hum, no biggie. We want to enshrine some religious bigotry in the Constitution, so we're not going to get some triviality like actually being real get in the way of our theocratic fascism.
And I think that is the point that was being made, excuse me, that the that if we're playing by Marquess of Queensberry rules, and they're not, right?
Right.
Then how – it's like why are we trusting that they're going to play – that they're going to play by the same rules we are, right? Like how many times do we have to be loosey with the football? You know, I think that's the frustration. Not that – for me anyway, I'll speak for myself. For me, the frustration is that – yes, they're not playing by the same rules we are, but how many times are we going to expect them to play by the rules that we play by? Like it gets a little tiresome when the Democratic Party and other independents that caucus with the Democrats seem to be trusting that these people are going to actually operate within the norms that we've within the democratic norms that we've decided that past generations have decided to set for us. Like how many times are we going to be loosey with the football and not call them out for their hypocrisy, not call them out for their
perfidy,
for their bullshit, perfidy.
I mean, that's a great word for this circumstance, isn't it? And by the way, Steve in New York reminds us, Bin Laden, with the Bin Laden raid, Obama asserted his power was under the authorization for use of military force. I don't agree with that, but I'm pretty sure that's what he used. I am too. I'm pretty sure. Thank you, Steve.
Okay.
And then Matt points out, didn't Trump kill an Iranian general with a drone? I mean, he obviously was immune for that. Yeah, that was a targeted assassination, and he bragged about it.
But I mean, that's something that specifically Congress says, or the Constitution says that Congress has the power to launch wars, right? That's something that.
Well, that's why Steve drew the distinction a little bit ago that the president has war prosecuting power, but not war making power.
Yeah.
You know, that the power to declare war, which is, you know, so 1787, is vested in the Congress of the United States, and we haven't done so since 1941.
It's nothing like a good police action every now and again. Huh?
Military advisors. you know, I always remember, I don't think this is untrue. When they first decided to attack the innocent people of Iraq, the original name was Operation Iraqi Liberation. And then somebody figured out that was a little too close to the bone because it spelled oil.
Yeah, a little on the nose. How dare they have our oil under their land?
Precisely.
That's my cynicism. My cynicism is showing.
I don't know how you hide it at this point in time, David. I don't mean you singularly. I mean the rest of us.
Yeah.
This court is corrupt. This court is illegitimate. And this court is going to do more harm than anything we can than anything we are imagining right now. And we're imagining some pretty horrifying stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and think about what we are, what's possibly coming, right? That this court may have to deal with outside of just this, current election, right? The Supreme Court's going to be called upon to adjudicate privacy rights as technology becomes more pervasive in our lives. What does that mean, and what are the ramifications on our privacy, given the advanced level of technology that we're creating? AI, right? Can a private company sweep up as much data as they want? Can they sell your data without your knowledge or consent? To make as much money for themselves by targeting you as a consumer, quote unquote. And what does that do to the right, the unenumerated right to privacy that the people have? What about free expression, the First Amendment, these new levels of technology? We're seeing it now with the social media. There's a court, there's a case in front of this court this term, the net choice cases. Does a state have the ability to prevent a social media company from moderating its content? Is that moderation or is it censorship? And can the government act upon a private company to subvert a contract, essentially, in the guise of protecting the public?
Well, and the place where I get, and maybe this is my little libertarian slip showing, the place where I get lost in all of this is trying to figure out how the First Amendment applies to a non-governmental entity.
That's the case choice cases that are pending right now.
Yeah. Because what was it? Texas and Florida moved to try to restrict a global company's ability to deal with bad information the way it sees fit. I mean, if we all had to talk like Sunday school teachers on Facebook, it seems to me that that's within Facebook's right to do. You know, I don't know if you caught it, but
me too.
Leon Scum is having a hissy. Well, I mean, he's not really having a hissy. The little right wing shitbirds are having a hissy because Twitter just put back in place its ban on deliberate misgendering and basically abusive behavior, and you know, deliberately using the wrong pronouns for someone. And the first thing that Chaya Ratchick did was to send a note to Leon Scum saying, "Have the rules changed?" And then listed the names of several trans women, followed by "is a man."
Wow, so hateful.
Oh, she's horrible. On the day that she gets run over by a bus, and then the bus driver backs up to make sure, I will not shed a tear.
But on that, right, the laws passed in Florida and Texas that you were just mentioning would make it illegal for a Twitter to pass a content moderation standard like that.
Yeah, no content moderation.
Right.
Or all for them and none for us.
And so this Supreme Court is going to decide whether that particular content moderation approach by Twitter can be regulated by the states or not.
Yeah, when there are at least two and possibly four members of the court who probably can't even turn on their own fucking computer, David.
I know. Isn't this horrifying?
You know, you got Sammy Bad Breath and Fappy sitting there looking at the blinking 12, 12, 12, 12 on their VHS VCRs and can't get it and can't fix it. And they're going to decide this.
they're going to decide this.
Yeah, this is ancillary to this. This exposes the problem with letting outfits like the Federalist Society decide who'd be good on the bench.
Mm.
You know, all of these. Kavanaugh came from inside the administrative state. The Handmaid. I've tried more cases than the Handmaid did. Gorsuch is just sits around in his office trying to figure out a way to tell black men to freeze to death.
Wow.
And
I remember that story.
And you know, then there's Sammy Bad Breath, who made a name for himself by, I think it was letting a 9-year-old little girl be strip searched, and saying that it was okay to shoot a fleeing black man 30 feet away, posing no threat to the cops whatsoever. It was okay to shoot him in the back of the head.
But that's why they got chosen by the Federal Society to begin with.
Right, because the cruelty is the point.
For them, it is.
I mean, I don't like where we are right now.
I don't either.
I am frankly frightened. But again, it's like what Glenn Kirshner said, it's up to we the people. Because the court is not going to save us. Now, what it's up to we the people means, I don't know. I know if you say that to a maggot, they'll attack the Capitol and shit in the rotunda.
I think he means that it's up to us to vote. But you're right. That's what it means to them, I think. And not only that, but like, who decides if gerrymandering is constitutional or not, right? It's not like we can just ignore the court.
No.
Who decides whether money is speech or not? We can't ignore the court. And the problem is, this court can't be trusted, in my view.
Please, tell me about it. Yeah, to a certain extent, my right to exist is going to be before the court sooner or later, and I don't feel good about it. Because the court, you know, the court said that Bostock protects gender in employment discrimination.
Okay.
But now they want to, old Balls and Strikes was part of the majority in that case. But there's a new majority in town, and if it comes to it, and this is what I've been preaching for a couple of years at least, well, the 4 years of Trump too. Everything that we ever assumed about the Supreme Court isn't any longer. The assumptions that we made about bedrock legal principles, black letter law, doesn't exist. Now, that gives me the fantods.
It really is kind of frightening. I mean, in a sense, it's comforting to believe that the Supreme Court is above the fray and apolitical. In a sense, it's comforting in a way, right? It offers a sense of stability.
But we need Supreme Court justices who actually know what it means to be a lawyer.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, somebody that's been on their feet in a courtroom.
Yeah.
Earl Warren was a Republican governor from what, the state of Washington?
I don't recall, or I don't know.
And maybe not, I'm not. Anyway, we need diversity, equity, and inclusion on the court. And it's sadly not in short supply. It's in
Well, I mean,
the three women have real world experience.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much for the gang on the other side. I mean, I think the handmaid was a corporate lawyer for a little bit, or she was with a silk stocking firm for a little bit.
And also
Brat was there, playing Robin to Ken Starr's Batman.
I remember.
And it's you know, going back to Rehnquist, he was just a he was just a government administrative lawyer. Fappy Thomas, as we all know, came to the court from being head of the EEOC under Ronnie Reagan, which meant that his only job was to make sure that there was no equal employment opportunities. It's the court's a mess, and what was said earlier about I think it was Matt who said it, about either expanding the court or prosecuting and impeaching these bastards. You know, remember, the immunity question does not apply to Supreme Court justices. If we had a Justice Department with the will to power, why do I even bother? Someone would be investigating and indicting Fappy Thomas for his open violations of the law in not disclosing all the goodies that he got from his timeshare owner, you know, Har Har and Lee Lee.
And the flip side of that coin is, like, what does it look like to the general public when people in positions of power aren't investigated or prosecuted for their criminal conduct, but people are dying in the street literally for selling Lucy cigarettes? I'm thinking of Eric Gardner in New York.
Yeah, exactly.
And what does that do to the court's legitimacy? And what does that do to the public's concept of the rule of law? And what does that do to constitutional governance? And
we don't have an answer.
And we don't have an answer. And the Supreme Court is so insulated from the rest of us that it cannot see that its decisions are actually destabilizing the republic, as opposed to what they believe. I am certain they believe is the opposite, that they are providing a measure of calm and stability.
Oh, that's, you know, that's what the Handmaid was lecturing on. I can't wait till you read her. we just need some tea and ladyfingers here, and we've got to calm the nation down. Bullshit.
And,
okay.
And certain,
by the way, I got a Horn Research Department rings in. Theo says Earl Warren was governor of California, and people still bitched and moaned about him when I was growing up. Believe me, I remember the venom. Oh, it was Gerald Ford. Sit, Liberty. Sit. Woof. Gerald Ford, famously, when he was a member of Congress in the 60s. Led an attempt to impeach Earl Warren when he was Chief Justice of the United States. I remember reading, what was it, The Brethren? And that was Woodward and Bernstein. And there was someone else on the court, and this was the Burger Court, I think, who was notoriously not a lawyer, but quite an effective justice. But that's neither here nor there. I need to say thank you to Colin. Thank you, Colin, so very much. Colin just knocked down a have a third of a show on me. So we've got about 25 minutes. If we could raise the other $200, that would be great going into tomorrow. But above all, thank you, Colin. Thank you so very much. Gary Laborman says, I still don't see this as an important victory for Trump. It isn't. It's as much a loss as it is a victory. But it's what the court did, and tell me if I'm getting this wrong, David. It's what the court did besides answering the basic question that has us sitting here going, what the fuck is going on?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because this has the potential to create a massive amount of mischief.
I don't fully have my head wrapped around the amount of mischief that it can create, but I'm certain that it there is mischief that will be made with this decision. Yes.
They never do this if there's not some mischief in the offing.
Right. The problem is I'm not a Machiavellian piece of shit, so I can't really foresee all of the different permutations of the way they're going to use this.
I don't know either, and I love what's being and the thing about writing concurrences or dissenting in part or whatever. The brilliance of a dissent is only for the historians. There was a segment on MSNBC today with Lisa Rubin, and I thought she did. I thought she was solid in her analysis.
That handed the presidency to George W. Bush. Has the Supreme Court assumed such a direct role in a presidential contest? Just how big a factor is the Supreme Court in this election?
Well, obviously, it's a huge factor now in states' ability to regulate who is on their presidential primary and general election ballots. I think this decision, and I know Neil wants to be especially careful, and I appreciate that, but I think this decision finally does put to rest the power of states to disqualify presidential candidates from their ballots. They say very quickly, you know, state enforcement of Section 3 with respect to the presidency would raise heightened concerns because state-by-state resolution would be quite unlikely to yield a uniform answer consistent with the basic principle that the president represents all the voters in the nation. And then the court goes on to talk about what could possibly happen if different states having different litigations of their own and different courts with different evidentiary rules reach different results. We would then have a patchwork that would result from that, that they believe is bad for the nation. In terms of what happens to the rest of this election cycle, Anna, I think that is yet to be determined in terms of their immunity decision, obviously. Mm-hmm. But you see in the in the concurrence from Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, a warning of sorts, in my view, to some of the other justices saying, we didn't need to decide anything more here than the principle that states don't have the authority to disqualify candidates for federal offices. And by going further than that and saying that only Congress has that enforcement power, you have decided something that didn't need to be done. Mm. And they say, we protest the majority's efforts to use this case to define the limits of federal enforcement of that provision because we would only decide the issue before us. We concur only in the judgment. They are saying, this is a warning, right? This is a shot across the bow. Don't decide more than you have to in this immunity case. If you don't have to decide on a general principle governing presidential immunity for all time, given how egregious the facts are here, let's not do that. That's what I read in that.
I have another quote I want to read. It says, quote, after ratification of the 14th Amendment, states use this authority to disqualify state officers in accordance with state statutes. Such power over governance, however, does not extend to federal office holders and candidates. So really overemphasizing this issue of states really only being able to decide 14th Amendment decisions for state offices and those who would be within their more local jurisdiction. I do think you bring up a really good point, Lisa, about how some of the justices are viewing this and the broader context about the influence on this potential, the potential influence on this election when voters are getting ready to go to the polls or already have in some states. I mean, you think about tomorrow, Super Tuesday, and the dozen plus states where people will be voting in Colorado and Maine, which of course were two of the states where the 14th Amendment challenge came up and had been accepted by the officials in those states and by courts in those states. There's still a lot of information lacking for voters when it comes to the candidacy of Donald Trump and his full depth of potential responsibility or accountability when it comes to January 6th. And so this issue of whether he has presidential immunity is huge. And Andrew, we got this decision on the Colorado 14th Amendment ballot question very quickly from the Supreme Court. And here on the presidential immunity issue, we won't even hear the oral arguments until late April. The D.C. election interference trial was originally set to begin today, as Neil had pointed out. So why wouldn't they have that on the same expedited timeline?
And we're not going to get the answer to that one.
So I just want to point out that discussion was limiting the ramifications to the current election. And I think what you and I, Roxanne, have been talking about has been broader than that. The ramifications that we're seeing are beyond
it's the mischief to come.
Right.
It's how this will be cited in the future. Just like the mischief that followed in the wake of Bruin and that followed in the wake of Dobbs. The greatest awfulness is often not in the case at bar itself, but in its progeny. Dred Scott was just one case about one man. And as much or more than anything, it led to the Civil War.
Yeah. And Plessy v. Ferguson took, 40, 50 years to get overturned after that horrible Supreme Court decision?
Yes.
And it took generations of lawyers chipping away at the precedent to get it finally overturned in Brown v. Board?
I mean, Plessy in particular, you know that Plessy was a planned case, right?
I did not, actually.
Plessy was sent to the court. Well, there was a Rosa Parks aspect to it, because if I recall correctly, he was a light-skinned black man.
I think so.
Who bought a ticket on the train and went and sat in the white car, and they said, "Oh no, you can't." And Plessy was born.
And that's right. And they were trying to get the opposite decision, right?
Yeah, they thought they were going to.
Yeah, I remember that now.
And then it blew up in their faces. So again, it's what comes after. You know, the concurring minority cited Bush v. Gore, when in fact the heart and soul of Bush v. Gore was this promise from the majority that it was a one-off and could never be used again. Yeah, how's that working?
Yeah, that goes back to my point of like trusting what they're saying and trusting that the system is giving us accurate information.
Yeah, it just isn't.
Yeah.
And by the way, Matt in San Francisco says the court, "Last year when I was in Washington, D.C., the saddest thing I saw was the Supreme Court building is now fenced off, so you can't even approach the steps. It was just such a clear message. Stay out, plebs. I thought back to when I visited Congress, people to advocate for funding of a health clinic that I was board president on. It was back during Bush, too. One good thing I can say about Bush is there was funding available for nonprofit health clinics. You know, Roxanne, I really don't know how American citizens can act like all this stuff is normal. Things are not normal. The court's been captured. It is illegitimate. How can anything good come from that?" Well, you know me. You know me, Matt. I always try to find the good in things. And so if, like, Ebola were to strike the Supreme Court, there's a 66% chance we get a good outcome.
Oh, my God.
Best I got. Sorry. On the fly.
Real quick, I want to circle back to this idea about diversity, equity, and inclusion on the court. And in a sense, there is diversity on the court with we have a Jewish woman and a black woman and a Latina woman and a handmaid. So, but if we're looking
there's
at...
There's the second cowbell for doing it at the same time as me.
Thank you. But if we're looking at it in terms of educational diversity, right? They're all from Ivy League schools, if I'm correct. There's no one from a state school.
No.
Or a regional private school, like the one I'm attending.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this strain of elitism, right? That all of our Supreme Court justices have been exposed to and that they're coming from. And that sort of educational experience shapes one's view of the world.
Yeah. I mean, somebody who's, I'm not saying it, but you know, somebody that's worked in the trenches, somebody that's been a prosecutor and a public defender, because there are a lot who have. Someone who knows what it means to be up all night long prepping a trial, or what it means to be on the bench for that trial and be up all night.
Yeah.
Reading your pretrial, preparing for your pretrial motions, or preparing for to administer an oversee voir dire. To be able to rule on the spot in the moment on a complex argument about old hearsay. It's like there's a tacit belief that the only good lawyers come from Harvard or that, Yale. I mean,
that is not only is that tacit belief pervasive on the court, it's pervasive in the legal academy as well.
Certainly.
I mean, the whole U.S. News and World Report ranking system. I mean, the decisions.
And see, there are so many things, and I know you're probably familiar with this now.
Yeah.
There are so many things that, for instance, if you get into a state law school, a state university law school like my formerly beloved Harvard on the Mon.
Yeah.
They don't give a fuck whether you stay or go. And so you have to fight for 3 years to stay in. Whereas in private schools, and for me, the comparison was between, say, Duquesne in Pittsburgh and WVU. The grade inflation, once you get past your 1L year, you're getting out with a diploma if you're at a private school.
Right.
And I'm not taking anything away from your experience in saying that.
Yeah.
In a state school, they will bounce your ass in the last week of the last semester of 3L.
That's horrifying. I mean, that's just scare tactics.
But the thing is, the argument is, if you come out of that state school with order of the coif and moot court and law review on your resume, and you've got a 4.0, you fucking earned that thing.
Yeah.
And there's no, and whereas the same cannot be said of coming out of Harvard that way, or Stanford, or Yale.
I don't even, one of those schools doesn't even do grades anymore.
Yeah, well, Yale, I know at Yale there are no exams in the first year. 1L at Yale is basically pass-fail. And if the check clears, you pass.
Wow.
I mean, all the stuff of the paper chase and John Houseman, maybe it was that way once. But no. And, you know, here's an example. It just so happens, this being more in Monday, David, I have a Jerk Deluxe Vance went to X and posted an excrement. And Vance said, I have a long memory. If you're fighting Trump and him at his endorsed candidates politically today, don't ask for my help in a year with your legislation or your pet projects. And then he got reminded.
Fellow Christians, everyone is watching us when we apologize for this man, Trump. Lord help us.
And then he also posted,
Trump makes people I care about afraid, immigrants, Muslims, etc. Because of this, I find him reprehensible. God wants better of us.
But now he's in the cult and the check's cleared and, you know, here we are. Well, the reason I raised him is that he graduated from Yale Law. Okay, he graduated from Yale Law and was in fact groomed by that awful woman referred to as the Tiger Mom, who it turned out was married to a guy who was absolutely a toxic predator. And they had predator parties at the house.
Some of these stories you have are just so shocking.
I just have a long memory. And that's who they are. That's what they turn out. And I once had a conversation with a dear friend years and years and years ago who said, here's what you have to understand. You go to a state law school, and they will teach you how to practice in that state, or at least in theory. They're not interested in teaching you the nuts and bolts of practice at Yale. They're interested in teaching you how to subvert the process, how to take accepted norms and turn them on their ear and destroy them. And I've never forgotten that conversation.
And it seems like we're reaping the whirlwind from that currently.
Yeah. You know, state law school graduates can interpret statutes from other states. You know, there's no requirement of lawyers who graduated from Harvard on the Mon that, you know, we write all of our briefs and our pleadings in blue and gold ink while eating grits and a pepperoni roll that does not have mayonnaise on it. Fucking heathens. Jesus. But this has been a fantastic conversation, David, and I cannot thank you enough for it. And I just want to finish off by saying, because I think I'm a much more positive person these days, you're going to make a fantastic lawyer.
Thank you.
You're going to be a good one. And you're going to be a good one because you're not going to accept the status quo. You're going to look for a way to make to use the law not to harm people but to hurt them. You know, one of the things that I always said about practicing law was that nobody ever walks into your office and says, "I'm having the best day of my life, help me make it better." I mean, maybe it's like that for lawyers who handle, I don't know, IPOs or something, but I think those people probably have bigger ulcers than you know, trial lawyers trying products liability or medical negligence. Yeah. But
I mean, that's
you're taking it all in and you're processing it and synthesizing it, and you're just so damned impressive.
Hey, thank you. That really means a lot to me. I really have to say.
Well, I mean it in complete sincerity.
Thank you. And this, thank you for helping me work through my frustration with this particular day as well. And I really appreciate your words. And I want to say my condolences for the loss of your friend last week.
I knew it was coming, but it's still not real to me. I mean, it still hasn't sunk in that I can't just tell the Australian girl in my phone to call him and he'll answer.
It's sad. I'm so sorry.
It's sad.
Yeah.
But thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I hope, you know, starting about, July of last year, things just got weird, and seems like people close to me, you know, that I loved. Scott,
yeah, I remember Scott.
I'm not okay.
I'm so sorry.
And I know a lot of most of the Horn Family Community congregation isn't either.
Well, my condolences to everyone.
Thank you, David. So, obviously, you're in 2L semester 2, right?
I'm 2L semester 2. I am over halfway done with this god-awful experience, this excruciating, horrible,
I told you you could have gone for something. You could have had an honest living. I told you you could have been a piano player in a whorehouse. But did you listen?
I didn't know. I went to law school anyway. I was like, damn it. No, I'm determined to make a difference. And then I got to law school and was I smacked in the face with reality. And it's in reality.
Wait, you want to do what?
Still smacking in the face. Right? Reality is a fickle mistress. She's almost a dominatrix with that reality. She is.
And not the fun kind.
Not the fun kind. She's smacking me in the face. She's kicking my ass.
She's like a phone sex operator that you call and get the rule against perpetuities explained to you.
Oh my God.
Well, am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. Law school is awful. It's just awful. I mean, I'm having a better experience this semester because I am taking, an access to justice class where we're actually talking about substantive things. Like we're talking about people's lack of being able to access the justice system on equal terms to those that have money and power and status. And that is, it's a refreshing conversation every Monday and Wednesday evening, which is not, we learn legal rules. And we learn legal reasoning and we think like a lawyer and we don't question anything. And I'm just sitting there sometimes in class, just seething, ready to say something. And it's gotten to the point, especially last semester in my criminal procedure class, where I would raise my hand. The professor would see me raising my hand and not call on me. Because I would probably bring up something that, you know, well, the Fourth Amendment is actually doesn't say what the court says it says here. But, you know, hey, you don't get to the top by questioning the status quo, I guess. You don't become a Supreme Court justice by pointing out the flaws in their logic and reasoning on a daily basis.
I always think of the epigraph at the beginning of To Kill a Mockingbird from Charles Lamb. Even lawyers were children once, I suppose.
Oh, my God. And the comment about Machiavellian pieces of shit, I've met several of those at my law school.
Oh, I have no doubt. I mean,
and I cannot fathom operating that way.
Psychopaths go to law school too.
Yeah, apparently. And they also get joint MBA JD degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm getting through it. But like I said, this semester is good because of the access to justice class. And we actually read something, by a professor at Harvard named Duncan Kennedy, and the name of the article was Legal Education as a Training for Hierarchy.
Oh, good God. That would be fabulous. I mean, that's absolutely so true. And I was going to suggest in the waning moments of the program, if you really want to ramp up your law school experience a notch, maybe during your summer break, and you really, really hate yourself. Because, like, we were talking about how, you know, the practice of law is not the same as it was between, you know, 1787 or 2000 or 2024.
Yeah.
It is self-abuse to do this, I warn you. But read Charles Dickens's Bleak House.
Write that down.
And Charles Darwin, of course, got paid by the word. And it's never been more true than with Bleak House. It's a fascinating story. And it all centers on a case in equity in Chancery. And I trust by now you know the... You know,
I do, yeah.
And it was a case of Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. J-A-R-N-D-Y-C-E versus Jarndyce. And I read it for a law and literature class a million years ago when I rode my dinosaur up to Tort Flats in Morganhole. And I hated every fucking minute of it. But when I got done with it, I was like, son of a gun. And we think our system's a mess. Because the case had gone through layer after layer, lawyer after lawyer, and entire lives had come and gone. And wow. since Dickens was first and foremost, in addition to being a brilliant writer, a social critic, remember, A Christmas Carol is a social critique. Not necessarily a redemption arc for a nasty old man and a happy ending for a little disabled boy. the circumstances of A Tale of Two Cities, the same. But that Bleak House, I think every lawyer should read Bleak House.
Okay.
Once you thoroughly despise yourself for the time that you've given to it, what you do after that is you turn to the greatest writer ever produced by the American nation, Mark Twain, and you read something much lighter and much shorter called The Facts in the Great Beef Contract. Do that tonight, David. Just because after all the Sturm und Drang of the decision today, you need a giggle.
Okay.
The Facts in the Great Beef Contract.
All right.
You will not be okay.
Okay.
If your sense of humor is anything nearly like mine, you'll probably have to reread given pages again and again because you can't stop laughing long enough to comprehend the whole page.
That sounds awesome.
Because it's a story of bureaucracy and trying to negotiate. You know, Matt in San Francisco just wrote a little bit ago about, you know, trying to get funding for that nonprofit health clinic. Well, this is a story about a man trying to get paid for the provision of some barrels of beef to the Union Army during the Civil War.
Ah, the red tape.
Yeah, before red tape may have even been a thing, the term. But it was Byzantine, to say the least. And by the way, mentioning Matt, Matt said, "Yay, David, this really was a great conversation, but everything great starts with poppers." Because I mentioned doing poppers on the smoker once I get it built. For all I know, you may be right, Matt.
Well, I thank you for allowing me this forum and this time to chat with you.
I'm so glad you called in.
I think I had fun with this conversation, and I'm sorry that I kind of co-opted the Moran Monday.
That's okay. That's why Titanic Tuesday comes after Moran Monday. We can catch up with it. We can catch up with any Morans that we missed.
Okay. I have to get ready and go to class. So I will say goodbye and thank you.
Well, thank you, David. Have a wonderful evening. Study hard.
All right. Good night.
Bye. And that was David calling from his digs, I presume, out there in Oregon as he comes draws ever closer to being two-thirds done with law school, and I really am proud of him. True, Brother Deacon Asa, true. Thank you, Ralphs. Ralphs just jumped in and took us down to 175 to go for fundraising, so that helps significantly. And Ken writing in, thanks, David, for your contribution to the program. Fairly unsure I understood all of the context, but still illuminating. Don't fret, David. We love you. That we do. Supreme logic, Ken said earlier, it's a one-winged dove flying in circles. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Y'all are never going to let me live that down, and I'm glad. Ken also said, how about current so-called representatives who were fake electors or participated in the insurrection? Mike Kelly's my alleged representative who did same. I don't know. If they are United States officials, apparently, if it's anything higher than a state-level office, state legislator, state senator, county commissioner, and the cowboy for Trump was a county commissioner, yeah, you can do that. But, for instance, the petition going forward, well, I think that the 13th Amendment argument failed in Georgia relative to Sporkfoot. It failed in Arizona in regard to, I think, Andy Biggs. Apparently, we have tinkerbelled Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. They didn't believe in it, so it's dead. So that's the program, everybody. Oh, but just one last thing. Nitwit Nero, who did not get almost any of what he wanted, said, I don't want to win this way. Look, I want to win based on my policies are better. And then said, I hope that the justices, because they'll be working on some other cases, but one in particular, presidents have to be given total immunity. They have to be allowed to do their job if they're not allowed to do their job. It's not what the founders wanted, but perhaps even more importantly, it'll be terrible for our country. Terrible. He's rattled. And by the way, I am going to take just a couple of minutes here. Apparently, the Trump administration, when they were in office, were members of the Dr. Hunter S. Thompson fan club or something. I say that because of the further revelations about Dr. Ronnie Candyman Jackson when he was White House physician under Nitwit Nero. And gave out drugs. Well, the Candyman can. The report is at Rolling Stone. It's called Trump's White House was awash in speed and Xanax. Great. Cites people who were inside the administration who said, the White House medical unit was like the Wild West, and staffers had easy access to powerful stimulants and sedatives. According to interviews with four former senior administration officials and others with knowledge of the matter, the stimulant was routinely given to staffers who needed an energy boost after a late night or just to pick me up to handle another day at a uniquely stressful job. As one of the former officials tells Rolling Stone, the White House at that time was awash in speed. Y'all peed skills. But it all suddenly makes sense. The president was an Adderall junkie, probably still is. Knowledgeable sources say that samples of the stimulant were passed around for those contributing lines to major Trump speeches, working late hours on foreign policy initiatives, responding to special counsel Robert Mueller's probe, coping with the deluge of media inquiries about that investigation, and so much more. but it wasn't just speed. Modafinil, also known by its brand name Provigil, wasn't the only controlled substances that Trump officials, young and old, routinely acquired. Whatever someone needs, we were going to fill this, one source with direct knowledge of the matter recalls. And the anti-anxiety medication Xanax was also a popular, easy-to-get drug during the Trump years, three sources tell us. Neither Xanax nor its generic, Alprazolam, is mentioned in the Pentagon report, which notes that it is not a comprehensive list of the controlled substances ordered during the Trump years. Two people with direct knowledge of the situation recall senior officials getting Xanax from the White House medical unit and sharing it with colleagues. This makes so much sense. You know who else really loved speed? He loved dogs, too. During Trump's presidency, two sources say senior staffers would repeatedly down Xanax with booze. And the first thing I thought when I read that was, huh. Meanwhile, there's Matt, it just gets worse. Snorting rails of hard-on pills and chasing them with Red Bull. He's a piker. But there they are. Yeah, again, straight out of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I didn't tell him about the bats. The poor bastard would see them soon enough. But I felt like we needed to get to that because a speed freak wants to be president some more. Yay. So that's it, y'all. Thanks to our Patreon and PayPal subscribers. Thank you to our a la carte contributors this evening. Thank you, Colin. Thank you, Ralphs. Thank you to all of our a la carte contributors, each and every one of you. Thanks to each and every one of you who shares your precious finite time engaging with the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to our news ninjas. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. HeadOn.live. Remember, like and subscribe to the podcast, please, wherever you download it. Podbean, Podcast Republic, Odyssey, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, what have you. Leave a review, like, subscribe. It does sincerely help. Oh, and Matt says speed at the White House. Crank was my drug of choice. I can't imagine being around 45 and being hyped on crank. Then to make it worse, all your coworkers are wired too. My God, it's amazing we still have a White House that's standing. Yeah, you know what, Matt? It's a miracle that we didn't get to the end of the Trump reign and everybody was just standing around, you know, like horses and stamping the ground. Yeah. Just need a little bump. But Hunter Biden was an addict. That is a terrifying thought, Matt. Being around all those wired people, except for the couple of mellow ones with the halfway closed eyes who are like, can't handle it, man. Just took his Xanax. Washed it down with some Pappy Van Winkle. Thanks, John Fox in Australia. It was nice to hear from John, Saturday night. The National Rugby League of Australia played their first ever games in the United States. And so John messaged me to tell me about it, and I watched his beloved bunnies, the South Sydney Rabbitohs, take on the Manly Sea Eagles. And I think it's because I actually watched it. John's beloved bunnies took it on the chin, especially in the second half of the match. I'm so sorry. It was funny though. Paying attention to the music they were playing in the stadium there in Vegas, and it was like old home week because they were playing Australian rock and roll. That John had turned me on to 20 years ago. That one in particular struck me, Run to Paradise. Great song. And I still don't understand rugby. But that's okay, because as long as I don't understand rugby, I do understand I will never, ever even get close to understanding cricket. So there's that. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, 25 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia, and a proud union shop. Stay safe, everybody. Get your booster. Not out of the woods yet. Get your flu shot. Not out of the woods yet. Wear your mask if you're around maggots, because we're not out of the woods yet. If nothing else, wear your mask around maggots just as a way of honoring the million Americans that Nitwit Nero killed by letting a deadly disease run rampant. Wash your hands, don't touch your face, use your hand sanitizer, carry it with you, pocket or purse. Maintain your social distance as best you can. And if Nitwit Nero comes towards you babbling about, I don't want to win this way, well, don't worry, dipshit, you're not going to win. And always, 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 Wayne and Gina, it's all for you. Later.